now. I mean, these agreements benefit the major multinationals, the transnationals, the Cargills and the Archer Daniel Midlands, and you know, all these folks that have major interest in the government.
So are you going to be staying up there for the next few days? What are your plans?
I'm leaving Saturday night, but there are plenty of people in solidarity here. There's a lot of
Is there a number that local Santa Cruzans can call if they want more information about what's going on up in Seattle? Do you have a phone number you want to give out?
Let's see.
You probably call the Resource Center for Nonviolence here in town. They're keeping pretty close tabs, and that number is 423-1626.
The Direct Action Network number.
Yeah, Mike Rodkin just suggested the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Do you recommend that number?
Yeah, that would be good.
And again, that number is?
423-1626.
423-1626.
Yeah.
Jeff, is there more you want to say? Or?
Just remember that we are engaged in a peaceful demonstration no matter how the media portrays it, and the 99.9% of the people are peaceful, and we are getting our message across, and just remember...
Mike Rodkin has something he wants to say to you.
Yeah. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I just want to thank you for being there, let you know that you're representing a lot of people in Santa Cruz, and appreciate your approach to this thing, and it's very clear that the vast majority of people there are interested in the peaceful but strong demonstration against the WTO and everything it stands for, and thank you for representing us there.
Yeah, well, thank you for just getting the information out. I mean, I think more and more people are waking up.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
And back to the shoulder tap, or perhaps other issues here. But
and I'm going to have to go fairly soon. I have about 10 minutes. So.
Mike has about 10 minutes. So, Becky, do you have any questions of Mike you want to put to him, or any points you want to make? I guess, Mike, you were making the last few points when the call came in.
Well, I was talking about the First Amendment's issues about that it does criminalize the content of speech. And that in the recently Salinas had a panhandling ordinance that was struck down in the courts precisely for that reason, that it was criminalizing the content of speech. One other issue that we haven't gotten into is City of Santa Cruz has an enormous number of alcohol outlets, probably about twice as many as a city of its size.
Twice the state average.
It seems to me if we're trying to reduce youth consumption of alcohol, we have to do something about how many outlets we have in the city. Why couldn't the city council adopt a policy that whenever a business is sold and they want to pass that alcohol license on to a new owner, that by attrition we start closing these down?
Let's we've got an incoming. I know Mike, you want to answer. Let's get this other caller as well so we can...
Which order?
Make it a 30-second answer.
Oh, quicker. Yeah. We actually have an ordinance in Santa Cruz that has to do with attempting to regulate the number of outlets we have in town. And it's not a question of the law. It's more like the enforcement of it, because as a practical reality, these licenses have a certain value. And if the city just takes them away from people arbitrarily, we would have to end up basically buying their license up, which would be quite expensive. But I support the concept you're talking about, and it's an issue of trying to find those opportunities where we've done it twice now, where we actually have closed down places. In one case, we had to pay quite a bit of money to close a place down.
How many places do we have in...
I don't know the number, but it is twice the state average.
We have a caller on the line. A caller got a question or a statement you want to make?
Well, the thing that I'm concerned about with this law is that they're saying that the justice system for the juveniles is a lot... less lenient. I mean, it's a lot more lenient than it is for adults, but the problem that I see with this law is the way it'll be applied is that a kid from the Upper West Side or from Aptos or somewhere that has a mother and father at home and has never gotten in trouble before or anything like that, nothing's going to happen to them. They'll write an essay. But some kid whose parents happen to be homeless, or maybe he only has one parent, or lives in a van with his parents, or lives in a little shack in Lompico somewhere, and maybe the parents have a drinking problem themselves, all of a sudden that kid is going to be put through the ringer and may actually end up in some instances being taken away from their parents.
Thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, I think this again cuts to the heart of what we're talking about here. Let's take this case. We're making this up, obviously. A Lawn Pico kid with one parent, and the parents have got an alcohol problem, and kids out there in front of a liquor store, shoulder tapping people to try and get booze for themselves. Again, the notion that the government shouldn't get involved in these things is we should leave this kid alone, we should not make this a crime, we should somehow have I think we all agree, there should be alternatives for the young person, positive things they could be doing, there should be counseling, there should be alcohol programs, but we should never, like, drag them in any way into the criminal justice system. The problem is, for many of these kids, if there's not some attention paid to them by juvenile probation, nothing's going to confront them with the problems that they're involved in. The behavior will continue to the point that more serious kinds of things happen, because that's what happens with alcohol abuse. And I believe, and the question then becomes, how do you organize the juvenile justice system in such a way that it's not punitive, that what happens to this kid is not that he gets locked up because he's got a single parent, or his parents are the parent is an alcoholic, but in fact, they get some decent counseling from somebody, they get some attention, some positive help from somebody, and I really believe that that's where our system is trying to go here locally. It's not perfect, but I think it happens more in that direction than the opposite, which is their kid's going to be thrown in jail because their parents are poor.
Caller, what do you think?
Well, I still think that, you know, the law will not be applied evenly. That poor kids that have parents of little means are going to end up being more severely punished under this law than kids whose parents have lots of money.
Becky, any comments on this?
Well, I wanted to say that Tim Fitzmaurice, when he was visiting some of the high schools, told the students that if they got cited under this law, it would be a $100 fine. I don't see that in, I don't see it in the content of the way it's written in this ordinance. Also, why doesn't it say whether it's an infraction or a misdemeanor in the content of the ordinance, in the actual language?
It doesn't need to, because municipal codes are always infraction unless it specifically says that it's a misdemeanor, so there's no question about that, it's an infraction.
Of course, the question arises, if there's a multiple offense, often that can be a misdemeanor. I don't know, is there some exception in this particular code?
Yes.
I don't see it.
That would not be the case. That would not be the case here, and again, you have to write that in. It doesn't happen automatically, and this would only be an infraction. It would not rise to the level of misdemeanor under any circumstance. The only circumstance that you could cite, which again, is the person does other kinds of things. Christopher gave the example earlier of a kid who's already on probation, or somebody's already been in the criminal justice system. So in those kind of circumstances, this could have some impact that rises at the level of misdemeanors, but this itself doesn't sort of work its way up through multiples into either misdemeanors or become a misdemeanor or end up with kids getting incarcerated for it. And again, anything in society, you know, could end up with a person end up eventually, a speeding ticket in a car could eventually end up with incarceration if you ignore the court, if the kid doesn't respond or something. So, I mean, it's not as if...
Well, that's a good point, because failures to appear are the cause for half the camping tickets, for example, in town under the sleeping ban go to failure to
appear.
But
that's probably less of an issue with young people in town than it tends to be with camping or things which are not necessarily local residents. Many of them are, but some are not. Whereas these kids, I'm assuming for the vast majority of them at least, are going to be local kids. Have no reason not to make it to court.
It seems the presupposition here is that involving kids with the police is somehow going to be have a positive impact on their drinking problems. That's your contention.
Yeah, and I think the issue is we've had a long view. I come from a sort of libertarian background, and I'm a member of the ACLU. And
not
I understand.
Recently.
Well, no.
At least not around the downtown.
Send my dues regularly. I'm a card-carrying member.
But the ACLU's position is different from your position on a lot of issues on city council.
Yes, that's often the case. Mm-hmm. But my view is that we should stop viewing the police as always sort of the punitive arm of evil that comes down on people. But in fact, the whole community policing model is the notion that the police need to be more integrated in the community, and that cuts in two directions. It means that the police need to become less punitive, the police need to see their job as more tied into the social service aspects of things, and it also means that the opposite is also the case, that the social service programs and so forth need to be better integrated into these kinds of dealing with these problems, and not wait for the kid to walk into a program under his own steam. But often the police can become a resource here in a way that they haven't been in the past. And I see that this transforming the nature of the police and transforming the nature of the social service programs, and I don't think that's a bad thing.
But do the youth see the police as a resource? I mean, let's look at the curfew ordinance, for example. That's
no,
when,
I
that's
think
when
if you ask people now
ago.
How they feel about the police, and again, it would depend on the individual circumstance, but in general, the attitude towards police, not just among young people, but among everybody. The police say, the first response is if you see a red light flash, there's some trouble.
I'm talking about the second response and the third response. Have you... investigated, let's say, the consequences that young people feel after being involved with the police? I mean, do you think, based on your research, that there is a significant, at the first I thought these guys were just a bunch of gun-carrying thugs that just wanted to impose their way of life, but now I realize they're after my own best interests?
I see some real change.
That impact?
I don't think it's been even close to 50%, much less 100%, but I see significant changes. The students I work with at the university on field studies, many of them work with the juvenile hall, the criminal justice system, alternative programs, many of which are locked programs, programs where kids are already in trouble with the law in some way. And I think there is a transformation going on where people in the past thought, you know, police bad, police evil, police out to do me harm.
Transformation in who?
In the minds of university students, in the minds of young, of high school students. For example, if you go and talk to high school students at Santa Cruz High about the police officers that work on their campuses, you don't get this kind of wave of negative, they're all horrible thugs or something.
Really?
Not to say that there aren't some kids that still feel that way, but I think there's been a very dramatic transformation.
Becky's
among young people on this question.
Can she respond briefly? Before we
remember when you were at Santa Cruz High and Michael Hernandez asked the kids about how they felt about the cops, and one kid after another got up and felt that the cops treat them like pariahs, that they're hassling them, constantly harassing them. I mean, several students got him up. Not one came and supported. I don't think Mike got the answer he was looking for on that particular question, but it does seem to fly in the face of what you're saying right now.
Robert asked me what my experience has been, and I've talked to lots of high school kids. I've gone and talked to high schools. I do it regularly. To junior high schools where these police officers there and asked the same question and gotten a much more mixed response. Now, the kids I talk to are generally in a classroom where it's sort of a mixed, you know, they're there because it's a whole classroom full of seventh graders or of ninth graders, rather than a group that came to a particular hearing for a particular reason. And I think given I think what I'm getting is a random kind of selection of high school kids, and I think it's very mixed, is what I'm saying. Some of the kids have the view that you're expressing clearly, and others have a very strong view that these officers are people that they get along with well, and they don't see them as their
enemies. The question is, what is the reality? Are they suffering harassment generally? And on the basis of age discrimination, this is what I think a number of young people claim. And caller, do you have any thoughts on this, or is there other questions you wish to ask Mike before he disappears, or any comments you want to make?
Well, I was just, you know, the big problem I also have with this is that it doesn't really spell out a maximum extent that they will go to if someone's arrested under this. That there's this whole litany of things that could possibly happen to these kids. And if this is going to be a no-brainer law that, you know, everybody should pass instantly and not even think about, well, let's have it completely spelled out, exactly what's going to happen to these kids, and look at that and see if we really want the total extent of what might happen to them happening to them.
I think the problem here is that there's very little knowledge about the way the criminal justice system works, particularly the juvenile. We know more about the adult system because all of us have been there for a traffic ticket or something or whatever, and or seen it on TV, if nothing else, the way at least it's represented, whereas the juvenile justice system is very complex. It's a very much more subtle system in some ways in terms of how people are dealt with, and I think that the caller is correct that there can be consequences that are severe, but I think the issue here is not statistics. It's not a matter of spelling out things properly. It's more a question of really understanding how does the system work and what happens, what are the various scenarios that can happen if a person is in fact brought into the system through a it wouldn't be normally arrest, it would be through a citation through the system.
It's also a question of whether you trust this system to actually have beneficial effects on the young people as it currently exists. And the caller is saying no.
I don't think it's a matter of trusting the system. I think it's a matter of working with the system and having some sense of involvement in it, which I feel like I do. And I think members of the public beyond city officials should have that level of involvement and understand how the system works. And if people see problems with the system and how it actually functions, they should get involved in trying to change that, because I think we have a very unique juvenile justice system here that really is trying to change itself. It's very unlike the juvenile justice system in a lot of other states where I've lived. It's very unlike the juvenile justice system even in San Jose, which is much more punitive than the one that operates here.
It's hard for me to take you at your word on that, Mike, because I know that you're, I'm hoping to do that, because your record on civil rights in terms of dispossessed groups locally has not been a particularly good one for the last decade, at least for most of us watching, whether it be the right to sleep at night or the right to peacefully ask for spirit change after dark in a non-aggressive manner, whatever it is, you've acted to criminalize these kinds of behaviors.
Let me say one thing, because I know you'll go on about it, just to say I don't agree with your characterization of my views on the issue. Just so the listener should at least know that. But my not responding doesn't mean I'm agreeing with everything that's about
to
follow.
Mike has to go, and no doubt he will explain to you how he disagrees with us.
Well, Becky? I find that the juvenile justice system is very arcane, and there's the public is not invited in there. It's very hard to even get an advocate into the juvenile justice courts. I've been up at the juvenile hall up on Graham Hill and been treated very rudely by staff up there who just obviously don't want observers in that system. And so, juveniles really don't have the kinds of supports when they go through that process.
It's the caller has another point, by the way, for Mike before you answer that. I'm sorry, he wanted to quit. He's been waiting. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, he keeps on saying the juvenile justice system is this velvet glove or something, and I personally know a number of families here within the county whose kids have gone through that system, and it basically tore their families apart. And I don't understand how you can ignore things like that and just say, oh, this is going to be in the best interest of these children. It won't necessarily be in the best interest of anybody except a bunch of lawyers.
Well, I think you need to look at, again, individual cases, because there certainly are cases where I'm sure the system's been negative for people, but there are an awful lot of cases where, were it not for the intervention of the juvenile justice system, these kids would be in a lot more trouble than they're in now.
And the other point, am I still there?
Go ahead.
Yeah, the other point I wanted to make was that in Margaret Marr's letter at the end, she includes part of the criminal code of the state of California, which shows that this is not a loophole you're closing. It is already illegal in the state of California to knowingly ask somebody to commit an illegal act. So a juvenile asking an adult to buy alcohol for them is already illegal in the state of California.
Well, let me ask, it's illegal
to ask somebody to do something knowing that what you're asking them to do is illegal.
Then why would everybody be all this concerned about it? If it's already illegal, then we're guilty of redundancy, but that's hardly a reason for a social movement.
Well, I'll tell you the reason. The answer to that question is obvious. If you make it an infraction, you enable the police to engage in these kinds of arrests more easily, prosecutions become cheaper, and it becomes a way of enmeshing more people in the criminal justice system, perhaps under the illusion that you're helping them by doing this. Are you claiming, Mike, that it's not currently a crime, that the caller is wrong, that Margaret Marr is an error here?
There are a number of things that may be currently illegal, but that are, I agree with you on this case, that are very difficult to prosecute or deal with because it's so indirect. The idea that it's illegal to solicit anybody to do something illegal is a pretty indirect thing, and you bring that to court, it's not going anywhere. So I believe in laws that are much
pretty glib. I don't know if that's necessarily true.
It's not glib. I believe in laws that are direct, clear, that people understand what's illegal, and the notion that there's an umbrella law in the state that says everything's illegal, to me, is both dangerous in general and specifically not helpful when it comes to particular things. I mean, the same debate took place on the issues downtown. It's illegal to assault people. So people said, why do you need to have ordinances that are...
We did indeed.
Why do you have to have an ordinance?
Because the merchants want them. That's the reason.
No, the reason is because, in fact, you don't want to overcharge people. You don't want to be in a situation where you're charging a person with a serious assault charge when what they've done is be obnoxious in a way that's beyond the level of reasonable behavior in public.
You want
an ordinance that actually sets out that says, this behavior is unacceptable. If you get involved in it, there'll be an infraction. You'll face consequences for it. But we're not going to drag you to jail because you were overly aggressive and asking somebody for money.
Well,
in fact, you do drag
people to jail unless they sign tickets.
I do have to go out, but I want to thank you for inviting me on the show. In fact, the caller for calling me.
Thank you, Mike, for being here, and we're going to hope that someday you will see the light.
There's always hope.
Thank you, Mike. Caller, anything you want to say before we hang up the phone here and give someone else a chance?
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Right.
Becky Johnson, you look like you got something you want to say.
I'm wondering why the city council went to Santa Cruz High School and solicited the input of the students there, the people who are likely to be affected by this law, when of the people that did speak, I think 8 students got up and spoke, 7 were opposed. Mike himself said he received a petition that said 155 names of students that were opposed to the law, and the petition that I circulate with about three other people at Harbor High and Santa Cruz High. We got another 65 names, all opposed to this law. Why did they go to ask these students' opinions if they're going to ignore what they said?
Because, of course, they were making a token effort and attempting to show their liberal constituencies that they were just oh so feel good and sweet and concerned about the rights of the people involved. As I said, they didn't go to the universities where they would have encountered some real hardened opposition to this kind of law. Who knows, maybe even protests. Instead, they went to a little classroom setting where heavily infiltrated by police, I might add. I've never seen so many police in a city council meeting in my life. Perhaps the only other time is when it was in the courtroom of Steve Argue when he was convicted, when half the courtroom was filled with cops. It was amazing. I mean, that's the answer, I think, Becky.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was just a showcase sort of thing, and that they really aren't interested in what the young people have to say. Another thing that I thought was interesting is this question about this youth center and where's this money for the youth center. Back in July of 1997, Scott Kennedy said that there was $250,000 in a fund for the youth center. And then at the November 1st City Council meeting, Catherine Beyer says that there's $125,000. And then just tonight, Mike Rotkin says there's $225,000. And that they've been working on it for 4 years and haven't gotten anywhere. It's kind of a mishmash. Doesn't sound like it's a very high priority at all. I'm wondering if those funds actually exist at all and what they are. We certainly are putting our money and our time and our energy, where the city's priorities are. And they are at police and incarceration. They're catering to what the merchants are asking for. They're certainly not rushing out to build the skate park or the teen center.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, Mike has assured us that that's only because the group that they selected 4 years ago hasn't done anything.
Yeah, that was interesting to hear that. I'm wondering why somebody 3 years ago didn't say, what's going on, group here? We're looking for recommendations. If you can't handle it, we'll find somebody else who will. Again, I think that, you know, actions speak louder than words, and this council really is not terribly interested in the needs of youth in this community. They should be allocating their time, their resources, and their money for educational programs about alcohol. And, all these alcohol providers, they provide a lot of tax income for the city, so I'm not surprised that Mike said that it was going to be very difficult to close down alcohol outlets in the city.
What I really object to, both from both these city council members, is in Crone's case, of course, I agree with his position on the shoulder tap law, and it's nice that he brings up the civil liberties issue, and I'm glad that he challenges the police department. I notice his ally, Keith Sugar, apparently has abandoned him on this one. It's a 6-1 situation for him at the moment. And that's too bad, because Sugar has often taken even a more militant position.
Well, Sugar had said that if he didn't get the stats and the solid information, that he was going to vote no on the second time around. So
well, Sugar has also he's also said he's going to call me back, and he hasn't called me back for 9 months. So I frankly don't know about Keith Sugar's promises.
Now, Byers, she supports it, but she thinks it's trivial, that will only involve a few cases a year, and will only happen in cases where officers directly observe youth soliciting adults for booze. Of course, Matthews and Hernandez, they're wrapped up in the horrors of youth on alcohol, and it's somewhat self-righteous wrap there. Of course, they have not addressed the First Amendment issues or the banishment orders issues, which I didn't hear Mike Rotkin answer that.
No, he didn't address those at all. I think we should say also that, actually, you have a list of, you made a very kind of elaborate list of points. Is there more you want to say about this issue, Becky?
I'm kind of going through here and kind of like sweep up, shall we say. And some of these letters are really, really good that came in, too.
You know, I just noticed that Rotkin has as usually glided glibly over a lot of this stuff. You know, he the specifics were not clear. I mean, he made these general statements about the youth authority. But frankly, you know, I just find it hard to trust his estimation. because he hasn't got the specifics. Just like Chief Belcher wants us to trust him, the police department wants us to trust them. That's not what you do in a non-police state. You don't just trust the police department. That's really, I think, a key factor. Crone's problem is, you know, he wants us to sit around, and I guess he wants us to do the work. And if we can elect a council majority in 2000, well, that's just fine. Otherwise, he's going to sit on his butt throughout the winter doing nothing to decriminalize homeless people. I note in what he was saying earlier in the show, there was not a word about decriminalization. He used the same line that Rotkin has used for decades about wanting more shelter space. You cannot possibly get shelter space for 500 to 1,500 homeless people. You need to decriminalize them, and I don't see him doing that.
This council hasn't provided any, the new council has not provided one additional shelter bed in this past year. The last shelter space that came online was in, I guess it was July of 98, was when Community House opened up and 40 beds there. But there's been no shelter.
Hence, it falls to us, to you out there, folks, in the audience, to do something about this.
On
the
Actually, there's going to be kind of a decrease in shelter now that the Armory under Ken Cole, and they brought the new mats in for sleeping at the Armory. They're
decided
redefining
only 100
the space.
People could be in there, yeah.
And they're going to pare that down to saying 100 is 100 spaces in the Armory.
Got to roll out of the studio. So, yeah, that's true, Becky, and I think that we're going to be covering in the next show on Sunday. We're hoping that we have a special interview with Attorney David Beauvais defending the explicit players, the folks who are performing nude in Berkeley and are being prosecuted for it. We're hoping to find interviews with people beaten in the last 4 days.
And December 14th is the City Council will be coming up with the second reading.
And that the number to call for opposition calls to the City Council is 420-5020, encouraging them to change their votes, although, of course, most of us think this is a done deal. You can certainly use this number to express your concern about the criminalization of people every night, the threats of violence they face, the lack of shelter, and the lack of any kind of real response. A year ago, people were at least talking about this issue. Not a word is being said about it at City Council, and there's been no positive change.
And don't forget that there's a benefit going on right as we speak down at the Vets Hall.
That's correct. Free radio. Free radio.
Who is this guy?
And we're going to let this new character who's entered the studio give you some of his talk, but we'll give you a little song before he comes on.
You don't have to be a teenager to drop out of things. Look at you. You jump through the hoop like a dog every time the bell rings. So you do. Your kid looked at you and he dropped out of college. His teenage decision was backed by the knowledge that daddy had dropped out of life. Don't have to take LSD to take off on a trip. Look at you. You make yourself blind so you won't have to look at the world. What a drip. So you do. Your daughter stays out late whenever she can. She don't want to be like her dad and her mom who've been absent the most of her life. You don't have to turn off the music to drown out the strife. Look at you. You make yourself deaf so you won't have to listen to life. So you do. You sit in the dark with your second-hand dreams. You're not even hearing the sound of the screams. When your kids leave your house of the dead.
Well, that's about it. I want to thank Robert and Becky for another great Bathrobe Spears broadsides with their...
Okay, it's about 9:10 on December 2nd. We're in Logos Bookstore talking to
Eric Stewart.
And Eric, you came up to me a few moments ago with some other disquieting news about troll busting.
Yes, basically 2 nights ago, that would have been November 30th. November 30th on Tuesday night, a friend and myself were making our way to camp in the vicinity of Natural Bridges. Basically, we don't camp there, we camp elsewhere, but that's confidential to me right now. Mm-hmm. We were walking our usual route. We'd gotten off the bus a few minutes earlier, and we heard a vehicle approaching from behind us. My friend had a sudden instinct, which is really out of character for him, to jump into the bushes and hide, and I joined him, not as much out of my own instinct as much as trusting his. They pulled up very close to where we jumped out into the bushes, and it became very obvious very quickly they were looking for us.
How did you note this?
I noted it because it was odd. I just thought it odd for them to stop within about 15 feet of where we had left.
Did you hear them say anything?
Well, my friend ran. I started to run after him down a path, and this vehicle, a white pickup truck, a quite large one, big wheels, very loud, old-sounding engine, pulled up a little bit further to where we actually had departed from the road, turned on a flashlight, which soon became a spotlight, and at that point I was ducking this way and that way because I didn't want to be an easy target. I didn't know who these people were or what. And we managed to escape. I soon heard them gun their engines, go and turn a corner, run back and forth in the area for a little while, and then leave.
And what area was this again?
The very end of Delaware near Schaefer.
Uh-huh.
We then heard them for about an hour traveling within the vicinity all around through the industrial areas around there. For about an hour, just seemingly.
You were hiding at this time?
Well, we could hear them pretty well, so we weren't quite in a state of hiding. We could hear pretty much the direction, the distance, and after that, they didn't really come very close to us.
Yeah, I mean, you were in your camp, or?
We were near our camp. We were just kind of, yeah, just being still. And
were there other people out in this area, or were you all alone out there?
As far as I know, myself and my friend are the only people that even heard the truck, as far as I know.
About what time of night was this?
I'm going to guess around 9 o'clock.
And did you hear any, was there any voices, any shouting?
Yes, as a matter of fact, when we took off, basically it wasn't much, when we took off running down the path and saw the spotlight behind me, I just heard someone yell, hey. It was pretty wet out. I figured they didn't want to get too wet, so they didn't come out after us. It was today that I heard a story from a friend that was a lot more alarming.
Tell me about that.
That he was in the very same area, and I will give you the details I'm sure of and not give you anything that I can't remember too well. He said he was jumped by two people, driven to the ground, had his arms twisted, was punched 3 times in the face, after which, and he was shown very quickly some badges, after which another police officer showed up to take him in. I understand.
Did he get the names of any of these cops?
Not as far as I know, but I'm sure that he could get it. At any rate,
did they say what he was charged with?
A drunk in public, which I've never known him to drink much. I know that he drinks now and then. Resisting arrest and something else. I'm not sure.
These were people in blue uniforms or plain clothes?
I understand they were in plain clothes, the initial two individuals, and when the officer showed up on the scene, he was heard by my friend to ask why he's on the ground or something to that effect, and they answered something vague like, well, that's how we found him or whatever.
So let me see if I understand that. You had another witness there watching this?
I don't know if he has witnesses beside that, but we hadn't told him about our experiences the night before. He came to me with this without knowing that we had experienced something similar the night
before.
So
he told you that while he was on the ground, a police officer in uniform came up and said...
And said something to the effect of, why is he on the ground or why is he in this position or whatnot.
And these two individuals identified themselves as police officers who attacked them?
Apparently they showed him badges.
And did they say what their problem was? Are they any other kind of colloquy with him?
I understand he asked questions like what's going on and was then punched or something to the effect. Or at that point, the physical aspect of his detention was
And you spoke to this man when?
About 3-4 hours ago.
And when did this incident supposedly happen?
Last night. He was taken to jail and released, I understand, without any charges.
And you say this guy has a first name?
Yeah, his name is Jason.
And how long have you known Jason?
I've only known him kind of well for about a month and a half, but I've been an acquaintance of his for about 3 years.
Is he a homeless person?
Is he?
Yes.
Yes.
And has this happened to him before?
Not that I know of.
How long have you yourself been in town?
I've been back about 4 weeks.
And our last time you were here was how long ago?
A year and a half.
Any differences?
Well, on the surface, when I'm walking down the mall, I feel a little bit less oppression from officers, but I'm hearing a lot more stories from coroners around Santa Cruz. Presumably, I'm the one making this presumption, that's because you can get away with less on the mall.
You mean the police can get away with less? Or?
Yeah, or whoever, or anybody that
would
be. I got the impression from this conversation that these people and the police that came were knew each other. From what I gathered from what he said.
So you're suggesting originally the people that jumped this guy were or weren't police officers?
They at least attempted to imply that they were. They had badges. My friend said he didn't see the badges real well, didn't have time to.
And do you think the people that were after you night before last were police officers or not?
I don't know, but and I didn't think so at first, but then I started to think about it when they had a very high-powered spotlight on me. Basically, about 10 minutes after they left, a police car rolled by through the same area with a spotlight looking through where we'd been. It seemed, you know, obviously that seems like something that's done in concert. It doesn't seem like much of a coincidence that they roamed those streets too with their truck for hours combing, or at least an hour, and that this officer was in a neighborhood for a while there. I know he was. I saw him twice. And that he didn't apparently find such a big pickup truck just roaming up and down those streets all that time. Unusually, he just found, you know, the presence of possibly homeless people trying to camp, something to concern him.
Did you file a report about any of this yourself?
No, I didn't, no.
Do you feel like you would be unlikely to, apprehensive perhaps, that you'd be facing
retaliation? I'm apprehensive that, that my need to sleep is going to get in the, you know, is going to be held against me legally.
Has anyone you know of, other than this, in the last few weeks been subjected to any kind of beatings or violence?
Since I've been back, I've heard a few stories, not someone I know personally.
And any sleeping tickets you've heard about? Or wake-ups, midnight wake-ups?
Midnight wake-ups occasionally, first alarm, yes.
On private property or public property?
On private property, yeah. I was basically told that if I didn't get up and move, and he came back in 30 minutes and I was still there, that something to the effect that I was going to be in a lot of trouble or whatever.
Where was this?
I don't know the name of the office building. It's an office building on a hill, and it's towards the clock tower end of Pacific and back a little.
Anything you want to add for the Free Radio Santa Cruz audience?
We should just stop giving badges to adrenaline junkies. That's all.
Thank you very much.
going? Glad I stayed in the studio a little bit later. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your specifics and how people can most effectively campaign to get you out of lockdown. The city structure or the county jail where you're at, or like who should we be pressuring to address your rights?
Well, I think the issue that, see, I'm really, like I told the star yesterday, I don't really care that much where they keep me in here.
Okay.
I think the issue is the fact that I'm in jail in the first place. Now, if they throw me in the hole, if they've threatened, if I do organizing against authority, if this guy, Babe, the guy in charge, told me I could be thrown in the hole instead, where I wouldn't have reading materials, I'd have cold showers. He said he threatened to remove my release date to half 3 months from May 14th to 3 months later, amongst other things, no visitors. That would be something, I think, more worthy of protest.
Oh, okay, you haven't been able to watch it?
No, I have a cell that
by and large, that's a good thing.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like, I don't get too distracted, but...
Yeah, and then ultimately, you know, you'll get to see a lot of the first-hand footage that comes out of the, you know, actual activists who were documenting it.
Well, so, yeah, I hear Charlie's come back from the left.